Hi, this is Bill Meyer. Thanks for checking out this podcast from Dr. Bill Meyer Live. You can hear the show every Saturday from 11 a.m. to 12 noon Central. And there are many more podcasts for this and all of our other faith radio shows available online. Our web address is myfaithradio.com. And thanks for your gifts to this listener-supported ministry. Enjoy the podcast.
He's a psychologist, an author, and a veteran broadcaster. But most importantly, he's a dad. Welcome to Dr. Bill Meyer Live on the Faith Radio Network. Stay tuned for a faith and culture connection, a biblical perspective on current events, and practical family advice with psychologist Dr. Bill Meyer. You can join the conversation by calling 877-93-FAITH. That's 877-933-2484. Now, let's join Bill Meyer live.
Well, good morning. It is so great to have you with us today here on the Faith Radio Network. We appreciate you taking Faith Radio along with you wherever you might go. And today we have an interesting guest who is one of the nation's top trial lawyers. Why am I going to be having a trial lawyer on this program? Because he is going to talk about the fact that today Christianity is on trial. It's on trial in the public square, in the media, in the academic world, perhaps even in the mind of somebody you know. And he believes that we can defend Christianity very powerfully and effectively, and he will tell us how to do that coming up in just a few minutes. So if you've ever struggled with, gosh, how do I defend my faith when I'm talking to an agnostic or an atheist or somebody who's hostile to Christianity, our guest is going to tell you how to do that and how to do it persuasively and effectively, and the many, many sources that you can use to defend the Christian faith. So stick around for that. I did want to address, as we start off the program today, something that happened earlier this week, and you can't ignore it because it's been in the news, it's been all over the news since Monday, and that is the death of Robin Williams. And I have to admit, I was kind of surprised at how it hit me, because, you know, Robin Williams was around making us laugh for what, 30 years through television and film, through such a long and distinguished career. And as I watched the news coverage of his suicide and just the retrospective of his life and looking back at, you know, all of those different films and television shows that made us laugh and all those different performances, I just found myself profoundly saddened by the thought that this talented man who brought us so much joy was struggling inside. I had known that Robin Williams had had issues with drug and alcohol abuse over the years and had been in treatment. I didn't know that he was struggling so severely with depression. And one of the things I've been thinking about this week is that when something like this happens, it can remind us of how important it is to care about and really listen to the people that God has placed in our life. And is it possible that you might have a friend or a loved one who is struggling with depression or who may even be contemplating suicide? And so I thought I would just mention a couple of the warning signs that you should be aware of. Because, you know, I believe this is our responsibility as believers to anybody who God has placed in our sphere of influence. So here are a few things to just pay attention to. If you have a friend or relative who has told you that they feel hopeless, or perhaps they say they feel as if they are a burden to others, something to pay attention to. Certainly if they say they don't feel like they have a reason to live. If they describe feeling trapped, or maybe they share that they are in unbearable emotional pain. If they're isolating themselves, they don't really want to have any relationships, or cutting themselves off. If they are showing extreme mood swings. If they've been maybe depressed or hopeless for some time, and all of a sudden they seem like they have this sense of resolve, and they're putting their affairs in order. Maybe giving away prized possessions. Man, oh man, those are some red flags that we all have to pay attention to. And especially if they've ever expressed the fact that they are wanting to die. Now, if you know somebody who has brought these things up, you might feel anxious about discussing the topic with them. But let me just tell you, if that happens, one of the best things you can do is to get them talking, get them discussing it with you. Gently ask them, have you actually thought about taking your own life? And there are some people, I think throughout the years, there's been some misunderstanding about this that, well, gosh, if I bring that up, I'll just be planting the idea in their head, and then they're going to be more likely to do it. Actually, just the opposite is true. All the research would show that if we can get a person actually expressing what they've been feeling, what they've been contemplating, they're less likely to commit suicide, especially when we're talking about teenagers. And you probably know that, unfortunately, a teenage suicide is a pretty significant epidemic in our culture. So if you suspect it, bring it up. Don't bring it up in a judgmental way. Bring it up in a loving, caring way. And if the answer is yes, if the person says, yeah, I have been thinking about that, then you want to get some help. One of the things you could do, there is a national hotline, the National Suicide Prevention Hotline. You can find them online. You could call our friends at Focus on the Family. They have a counseling service, free telephone counseling service. And if you call Focus 1-800-A-FAMILY and just ask for their counseling department, they'll put you through to one of their caring Christian therapists. And I happen to know a lot of these people personally because I worked at Focus on the Family for almost 10 years. And they will do a crisis counseling session with you or help you if you know somebody who's going through this. And then refer you to a Christian counselor, a licensed therapist in your local area, somebody right within a few miles of you. They have thousands and thousands of therapists on their list. And here's something else to think about. If you are a follower of Jesus Christ, remember that the Bible tells us to encourage one another and carry one another's burdens. I don't believe those are just suggestions. I believe those are commands. Encourage one another. Carry each other's burdens. Pray for one another. Confess your faults to one another. That's one of the problems that we have, I think, in many of our churches. We go to church with these, you know, bright, shining rainbow faces, and inside people are in so much pain. So just something to consider this week in light of the death of Robin Williams. As tragic as it was, perhaps some good will come out of it. If we will pay attention to those people around us and really care, really start to take an interest in those. We get so busy in our day-to-day lives and just kind of moving ahead with family and career. Sometimes we don't really have time. We don't build in margin for those who might need a friend, who might need someone to talk to. And I think that's a challenge for all of us, and I'm including myself in that. I get too busy as well. And if you are struggling with depression this morning, if you've been feeling hopeless, please, please reach out to somebody in your life and let them know what you're going through, and certainly reach out to God. 1 Peter 5:7 says, cast all your anxiety on him because he cares for you. Well, it's 12 minutes past the hour. I'm Bill Meyer, and this is the Faith Radio Network. Coming up, we're going to be talking to Mark Lanier, one of the top trial attorneys in the nation, about how we can confidently defend Christianity. That's up next here on the Faith Radio Network.
It's Dr. Bill Meyer live on Faith Radio. Get ready to join the conversation. Now let's join Dr. Bill Meyer live.
And we'd love to have you join the conversation. You can give us a call at 877-93-FAITH. 877-93-FAITH is the number. Whether you are listening to us on Faith 1200 in Fargo-Moorhead, perhaps on Faith 1270 in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Maybe you've tuned in on Faith 1190 in beautiful Madison, Wisconsin. On Faith 90.5 in Duluth. Or maybe you're listening in Waterloo, Iowa, Faith 1090. Or right here in the Twin Cities and all across the state of Minnesota on Faith 900. We appreciate you making us part of your weekend. Our guest this hour is Mark Lanier. He is the founder of Lanier Law Firm. He founded this organization in 1990, and since then he has earned widespread recognition as one of the top trial lawyers in the United States. The National Law Journal has twice named Mark one of the nation's top 10 trial attorneys as one of the most 100 most influential lawyers in America. He's been a frequent guest on television news shows. You've probably seen him on NBC, Fox Business News. He's actually a regular contributor and co-host on Varney & Company. And today he joins us to talk about his new book, Christianity on Trial, A Lawyer Examines the Christian Faith. And Mark, welcome to Faith Radio.
It's an honor to be on your show, Bill. Thank you for all you do and all you teach.
I appreciate that. Mark, let me ask you, why did a trial attorney decide to write a book on Christianity? I mean, you could be in the courtroom defending a client against, you know, some major lawsuit, and yet you took the time to sit down and write this book to help people defend Christianity. What spurred you to do that, Mark?
Well, I hope, like many of your listeners, I have found in my life that Christianity is a true explanation, not only of why the world is the way it is, but why I am the way I am. And so my faith is not simply a place I go on Sundays to church or bring my kids to or share familiarly with those who are interested. My faith is very real. It's actually the truth. There is a God who loves us. There is a God who is the author of who we are as humanity, that he's reached out to us. We are truly sinful beings that have been purchased with the blood of the Lamb. And so it's the truth in life. And I do practice law. Your listeners can Google my name and they'll see me in cases that there are headlines around the United States. But all of that is just that's my tent making. That's what I do, what I care about. My passion, first and foremost, is our Lord.
You know, Mark, I mentioned at the beginning of the program that the title of the book is very apropos because Christianity is indeed on trial. It's on trial in the media. It's on trial in the political world. It's on trial in academia. It may be even be on trial in our personal relationships. We have friends or relatives who are agnostics or atheists and are really in our face about, you know, it's all a myth and how can you believe in this? And it is so critical for every one of us. And the Bible commands us to have a defense at the ready and, of course, to do it in a winsome way with love. But I think, and you tell me what if you believe this to be true, I think there are, unfortunately, the large majority of Christians do not feel equipped to be able to defend the faith. Is that your experience as well?
Absolutely. That's been my experience, Bill. And this book is not an exhaustive treatise on every argument that can be raised for or against the Christian faith. But what it is a good, thorough presentation like I would do in a courtroom if I were trying to persuade a jury one thing or another. Any time I try a case, what I try and do is present the truth. I think that truth is very powerful. That's what our justice system should be about. I don't take a lawsuit if I don't believe in it because it's just not a proper usage of my time or the courts. But once I'm in there, then what I want to do is I want the jury to hear the evidence, pro and con, put that evidence in scales, and decide what the greater weight of the reasonably credible evidence is. In other words, what does common sense tell us is the most rational conclusion from these facts? And the problem with many Christians today is they don't know how to first frame those issues And then second, they don't know how to really sift through the evidence, to examine the evidence. So I'm trying to get that into the hands of believers, but also there are many skeptics and cynics who've been reading the book, and I'm loving the way it's engaging them in conversation as well.
All right, let's talk about framing the debate. Mark, let's say we have a listener who has a friend or a work associate, relative, who is just really, in their face about their faith and challenging them at every turn. How do we, rather than getting into the minutiae, which I think a lot of us tend to do, or we take, we try to defend a specific argument that someone might make, how do we need to back up, take the 30,000-foot view, and frame the debate?
Well, the first thing I would do with such a person, and of course it's going to depend on who they are, where they come from, what their personal disposition is, and things of that nature. So the book has got a number of different approaches throughout it. But the 30,000-foot view, to me, is so often people say, you cannot prove your faith to me. And if you don't prove it, then I'm going to assume that it's false. And the problem is, most people, when they speak of proof like this, they're thinking about something they learned in their algebra class or their chemistry class about how you can prove that 2 plus 2 is 4, or you can prove that this substance is an acid or a base, or you can prove this chemical reaction shows the presence of oxygen. That's a laboratory type of proof, which is very valid for laboratory matters. But do I love my wife? Was Napoleon at Waterloo? Who ran the red light? These are not laboratory matters, and so no courtroom in the nation will try to prove whether or not Johnny committed the crime, whether or not Susie ran the red light. That's never done with laboratory measurements. It's done with scales and asking the question, which is more likely than not? This is called the burden of proof or the preponderance of the evidence. And I'm telling you, Bill, we'll take someone's life through this burden of proof. We'll use it for capital punishment. We'll use it to take property. We'll use it to change custody of children. We have found in the human civilization that the American court system is the very best way to establish these matters of truth. So when we ask, does God exist? When we ask, is there a basis for believing right and wrong? Is there a basis for thinking the Bible could actually be scripture? Is there a basis for thinking Jesus could be resurrected? Those types of questions, you should never prove them or think that you've got to prove them by some scientific analysis. You need to recognize that you need to prove them by the preponderance of the evidence. And at the risk of prattling too long, let me tell you one example I use. If I need to measure the distance between me and the nearest door, I can look at it and I can say it's about 15 feet where I sit right now. However, if I need to measure the temperature in the room, it's 72 degrees. Now, there's no way I can say that the distance between me and the door is 72 degrees or 80 degrees or 40 degrees. That's the wrong measurement system for that distance. It's a valid measurement system. It's just wrong for distance. I can't say there's 3 gallons between me and the door. Gallons measure liquid. They don't measure distance. So scientific measurements work in the area of chemistry. They work in the area of medicine. They work in the area of electrical science. They work in math. But that's the wrong way to prove anything, like, was Napoleon at Waterloo? Well, you can't prove it that way.
So when we're looking at that burden of proof and we're backing up out of that argument maybe we've caught ourselves in with that agnostic or atheist friend of ours, what do we say to them? What are the words we use to help them understand and to frame the debate properly?
Well, I urge them to recognize, first of all, and please understand, this book is not just grown out of my legal practice. This is grown out of my experience. I engage atheists and agnostics and unbelievers on a daily basis It's something I do with great joy, because it's a chance to share with them some truth. And the first thing I generally do is I say, you know, let's make sure we're asking for the right kind of proof. We're not going to be able to prove this in a formula sense, like the hypotenuse theory for measuring the right triangle. What we're going to do instead is we're going to put things in the scales and ask what's more reasonable. And then once we do that, we can take our lives itself and say, let's just look at your personal life. And let's see, does your personal life indicate that there's a God or there's not a God? And most people will say, well, of course my life indicates there's not a God. And I say, well, time out. And frequently I'll go to the moral argument, because most people I talk to are very moral. And I'll say, so Adolf Hitler, good or evil? Evil. Is what he did right or wrong? Wrong. Why? Well, because it was illegal. Well, no, actually it wasn't. Everything he did in Germany was legal. He passed the laws, then he did it. Well, but the world disapproved. Okay. So is right and wrong determined by how the world approves? If so, if the world approves of this, that, oh, no, no, okay, well, it's not the world, it's the natural order of things. Well, the natural order of things, if I look in the ocean, fish eat fish, people kill people, lions kill lions. You cull the herd, you improve the genetics of the herd. What's wrong with what Hitler did? And eventually someone is going to recognize that while their life confirms there's morality, there is right and wrong, their heads cannot explain it absent finding a higher power that's defining right and wrong, absent a God.
Mm, very well said. Let me ask you one other 30,000-foot level question. In our legal system, we talk about the fact that a person is innocent until proven guilty. But it seems that when we talk to many agnostics and atheists, they take just the opposite perspective. Christianity is false until you prove it to me that it's true. How can we avoid getting caught up in that debate?
Well, I think, first of all, that's going to be a predisposition of many people, and I don't know any way affirmatively around it. But it really doesn't bother me, to be honest with you, Bill, because I think we have very reasonable reasons for believing in our faith. I was having this conversation with a group of lawyers. The one lawyer, I was speaking at a legal seminar in Scottsdale, Arizona, and I talk about this in the introduction to the book. It happened just earlier this year. And in the process of finishing my speech, I'm about to head back to my hotel room when one lawyer comes up to me and he says, hey, everybody knows you're a Christian. And I said, yeah. He said, I don't believe there's a God. He said, prove to me there is. Prove to me with a courtroom that there is.
Oh, boy.
And my response was, I'd love to. And nine lawyers pull up chairs, and we started a discussion.
Oh, okay. We've got to hear more about this, Mark, after our break. This is wonderful. Our guest is Mark Lanier, and we're talking about his book, Christianity on Trial. On the Faith Radio Network. We actually have three copies of Mark's book to give away at the end of the hour. And if you call us right now, give us your contact info. We'd love to put you in a drawing for those books. The number is 877-93-FAITH. Just give us your name, address, phone number, email. And at the end of the hour, again, we'll have a little drawing for, by the way, it's not a lottery, Mark. 877-93-FAITH is the phone number. Here at the Faith Radio Network. We're going to take a break and be right back.
The conversation continues right now, and we want to hear from you. Call us at 877-933-2484. That's 877-933-2484. Now, here's Dr. Bill Meyer again on Faith Radio.
And welcome back. We appreciate you joining us on this weekend in the Upper Midwest as we talk about defending the Christian faith. And our guest is one of the nation's top trial lawyers, Mark Lanier. He's written a new book called Christianity on Trial, A Lawyer Examines the Christian Faith. And Mark, just before the break, You mentioned that you were at this, I think it was a legal convention, and this attorney came up to you and said, hey, I know that you're a Christian, you're a believer in Jesus Christ. Prove it to me. And you said at that point, a bunch of your colleagues sat down and started discussing it. Now, tell me how that conversation proceeded from there.
Bill, as a psychologist, I think you would have really had a special joy, not to mention being a Christian psychologist. So, but the other eight pulled up their chairs, and I looked around, and I realized one of them was a New Ager. I realized three of them were Jews with some measure of Jewish practice, though I'm not sure that much faith. Then I had about two or three Jews that were totally atheists and agnostics, and then I had this flower child who was in full denial, who had asked the question from the northwest, excuse me. So the lawyer from the northwest said to me, he said, you know, Lanier, I don't believe there's a God, and I've looked at it and I've examined it, and there's just not enough evidence, and you can't believe there's a God. Come with me. And he started doing this motion with his hands of reaching out and pulling me towards him. He said, come with me to the area of unbelief. Share this. And I looked at him and I kind of chuckled and I said, I can't come with you, Vic. And he said, why not? And I said, it would take too much faith. And he said, what? And I said, I just got to tell you, I'm looking at this from an objective perspective, I hope. And from an objective perspective, I would have to deny too much reality to walk away from my faith, because my faith is what explains to me the way you are, the way I am, what we do for a living, why justice matters, why there's a right and wrong, why we can pursue the bad guy in court with a good conscience that we're doing a good thing. The only way that works for me is if there is something beyond us that defines good. At which point, one of the unbelievers said to me, he said, well, Lanier, I am what you call a golden rule atheist. And I said, yeah? He said, yes, I do unto others as they would have me, as I would have them do unto me, but I'm an atheist. I just do that because it's a good way to live. And I said, and as an atheist, why do you do that? And he says, it's the best for the universe. And I said, have you studied your evolutionary beliefs? And he said, what do you mean? I said, your whole belief system is one that says those who are most fit for the environment are the ones that survive and continue to thrive. That's survival of the fittest. I said, now, if you believe that to be true, and there's nothing else giving dignity to humanity, like a God, then you've got to tell me that survival of the fittest is the rule, and it's a dog-eat-dog world, and you should be out there devouring people, not treating them as you'd like to be treated. And he looked at me, and he said, I try to look for the common good. And I said, do you really? And he said, yes. I said, so for the common good, if there's a person who's lying in a coma and they're never going to get out, should we go ahead and kill that person to stop using resources on them? And he said, no, emotionally it may help people who are alive to keep that person there. And I said, well, let's go a step further. Let's say the person dies. There are people dying in the world of starvation. A dead human body, like a dead animal, contains a lot of protein. Should we take everybody who dies and take their bodies and cut up the protein and feed it to the other animals of the world such that we've got adequate food for everybody? He was, no. I said, well, what is it about a human being, even dead, that in your value system gives dignity and honor to that human being? Well, they're human. I said, I understand that. And as a Christian, I think humans are very special because we're made in the image of God. We're endowed by our Creator with inalienable rights, including dignity and things like that. But where do you answer that question? Why for you, if we're just a collection of atoms, why shouldn't we be using those atoms to further humanity? He said, well, I don't know. And I said, but if your life is going to be consistent with your belief system and you're going to stay an atheist, then you've got to change your view on that, don't you? And don't you need to start advocating using dead people to feed?
Soylent Green, Mark. Do you remember that movie with Charlton Heston?
That's exactly right.
Oh, my goodness. And where did he go? Where could he go?
Well, I mean, ultimately, he just said, I need to think about this. I said, yeah, you do. And so I've written the story up. I gave him a copy of my book. And I said, you read that and you tell me if I got our conversation right. He called me up afterwards and he said, you did. And he said, I'm still thinking about it, but we need to talk some more. And so our conversation is not over. I continue to pray for him. And I look forward to the day I embrace him as a Christian brother.
Boy, that is so exciting, Mark. And it demonstrates that all of us can be effective evangelists, apologists, if we do our homework, if we take the time to learn these defenses, to understand what we're dealing with. The problem, as I see it, is, and again, you correct me if you think I'm wrong here, we have in the church today so many believers, and unfortunately so many churches, that are ignoring this aspect, this critical aspect of the faith. And we have so many believers that go home at the end of a hard work day and they just turn on the tube and they veg out for several hours. They never pick up a book. They never read C.S. Lewis. They never learn about church history. They pretty much go through life just, you know, not as a bad thing to do a good job and have some relaxation time and spend time with your family, love your family. But as a believer in Jesus Christ, if indeed we are, you know, ascribing to this faith, and if we say we are a follower of Jesus, I believe it behooves us to spend, gosh, what about 30 minutes a day reading apologetics, understanding our Christian worldview, learning some of these things that you're talking about? Do you get into conversations with your fellow believers about this?
Amen to that, Bill. Amen. And let me say, I call it hamster wheel Christianity. People get on that hamster wheel of life, and they run, 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 and they're not really going anywhere. And then they'll get off it to go eat, or they'll get off of it to go to sleep. But that's basically what their life is. They're running on a hamster wheel. And I want to say to them, stop. Please stop. Our God is such an incredibly majestic, wonderful, entertaining, thrilling, fun God that you are so missing out on life if you don't engage him and get to know him in the nitty-gritty, in the everyday. There's going to come a point in everyone's life where they're in desperation row, and it's, God, help me. And I wish so much those people had lived, oftentimes they haven't, lived a life where they've gotten to know God so well that they already know the help they're going to get and how they're going to get it. And they know you're investing not only in your own life, you're investing in the lives of others, in your family, in the church. When you grow in the Lord, Jesus Christ himself, God made man, Jesus Christ himself would get up early in the morning before he engaged all of his disciples and all of his ministry, and he would go off by himself to a quiet place to spend time with the Lord. The Apostle Paul, the most incredible apostle in the New Testament writing era, at least, the Apostle Paul would not just became a Christian on the road to Damascus and went to Damascus and lived his life from there, but he took time out and he went and he learned and he grew and he understood and he spent time in study, and it lasted to the end of his life because he writes Timothy and says, hey, when you come, can you bring my scrolls and my parchment? Because he still wanted to study. Heavens, if Jesus needed it, if Paul needed it, who are we? And the thing is, it's not just need. People are missing out. I went to our church leadership, and I worship at a marvelous church, and I said, I'd really like to teach a class on biblical literacy. And your listeners can find it. Everything's free, biblical-literacy.com. I said, I'd really like to teach a class on biblical literacy. We started out with 50 people. Our attendance runs about 750 on a Sunday in that class now because people are finding out that it is invigorating and life-changing to engage the Word of God.
It's so exciting, Mark, and I'm thinking back a few years ago. I think it was J.P. Moreland had a book that came out, Loving God with All Your Mind. And a lot of what we're talking about here is engaging the gifts, the intellectual gifts that God has given us. And we don't have to be a Rhodes Scholar to understand these things. I mean, many of these things, just the average person can learn, understand, equip themselves to defend the faith. I think a lot of us get a bit fearful and even defensive because of really what's happened maybe just in the last 10, 15 years with the neo-atheist movement. The media, you know, gives the neo-atheists such, you know, broad coverage, and many of their arguments, and you know this because you're a trial lawyer, they really are spurious. They fall flat on their face under scrutiny. And yet we just kind of cower in the corner thinking, gosh, it's just, you know, it's going to be so hard to defend my Christianity because there's all these great arguments against me. And that's not really the case, is it?
No, it's not. And if your listeners would just get out there and start engaging in some of the marvelous books, and I'm not saying go buy this book of mine, I'm saying go find many of the marvelous resources that are out there. My son is as bright a fella as there is in the world, I'm convinced. Of course, every father is. My son teaches logic and philosophy at Oxford University. Wow. He has his PhD from Oxford. He has his master's from Oxford. He is as smart a guy as is walking on the planet, I'm convinced. At Oxford, he had a copy of my book in his apartment, and an Oxford engineer was in his apartment and walking around and just had some time and sat there and read it, asked to borrow it, borrowed the book, came back to my son and says, I got to tell you something. I have always thought that nobody could have intellectual credibility and be a Christian. I've read your dad's book, and I've changed my mind. These are the smartest of the smart people who recognize when they examine them that so many of the arguments trumpeted against our faith are spacious arguments at best. They're not credible arguments. I mean, there's a reason to believe what we believe, and that's because it's true. And we never need to be afraid of examining the truth. We need to look forward and be excited to examine the truth.
Mm. Mark, let's dive into some of the arguments in the book. Explain, as an attorney, educate us on the difference between direct evidence and circumstantial evidence, and how do you use that evidence when examining God and the Christian faith?
Well, if you were in a courtroom, I'm going to start a trial in 2.5 weeks, and you read about it, it'll be in the papers. It's a big case in the country. But I'll be telling that jury 2.5 weeks from now that the law lets me prove things two ways, by direct evidence or circumstantial evidence. Direct evidence. Let's say we want to know, is it going to rain outside or is it raining outside? I walk outside, I look at the sky, I see the rain coming down, it hits my body, I walk in, I can say it's raining. That's direct evidence. I witnessed it. Or I could be standing near the door, I could hear the splash of raindrops on the door, I could hear the thunder, the door could open and someone could come in with a gust of wind shaking the water off of their raincoat and pulling down their umbrella, which is soaked to the skin with water, and they could say, oh, it's horrible out there. And I could also say, I now have evidence it's raining. It's not direct, it's circumstantial. These circumstances have shown me it's raining. I didn't see the rain, but I saw enough circumstances to affirm it. Now, when the court will tell a jury, rightfully so, many things are only proven through circumstantial evidence, and you're entitled to give full weight to circumstantial evidence. If I want to say Jesus Christ was resurrected from the dead, now, I don't have firsthand evidence of that. I have not witnessed the empty tomb. I was not there on Easter morning. I can't give you any firsthand evidence, but I can give you circumstantial evidence. And what you need to realize is no one can give you firsthand evidence he wasn't. Nobody can say to me, here's the body. So you don't have any firsthand evidence either way. All you've got is circumstantial evidence. So let's put all of the evidence in the scales, and let's see which side makes more sense. And so in the book, for example, I put in one side of the scales all of the evidence for the resurrection. Eyewitness accounts, lives that were changed, people willing to die over it, examine the motivation of the eyewitness accounts to see if they had reason to lie, to be disingenuous, to see if they're nut jobs, all of that kind of stuff. All of that evidence on one side of the scales. On the other side, what's the evidence Jesus was not resurrected? There's really only one thing that's in that side of the scales, and that's this. That doesn't happen to people. You know, it just doesn't happen. People, I mean, you might have 2 minutes down before they re-jolt you with the machine, but nobody's in there for 3 days and comes out. It just doesn't happen to people. And then I say, okay, let's look at that evidence. It doesn't happen to people. Yet we're not saying Jesus Christ was an ordinary man. Don't tell me it can't happen with God. If God either dictates it to people or if God himself is that person, don't tell me it can't happen there. So for me, the question's not, did Jesus rise from the dead? That's like a gimme. If there is, in fact, a God who cares about humanity and sin is for real, then there's not a doubt in my mind that the evidence is compelling Jesus is resurrected. The real question and the real debates are going to be, is there a God? And if so, what kind of God is he, she, or it? You know, is it a massive supercomputer, or is it a God of morality, personality, or personage, I should say? You know, what kind of God is there, and does that God care about humanity? And are we human beings that can make choices, or are we just a combination of our genetics bouncing off the environment? You know, is it all the chemical formula going on in our brain? That type of stuff is the real issue.
Our guest is Mark Lanier. He is the author of Christianity on Trial, A Lawyer Examines the Christian Faith. We have 3 copies of Mark's book to give away, and if you would like one of those, give us a call. Give us your contact info. Our number is 877-93-FAITH, 877-93-FAITH. It's 1148. We'll talk to Mark about a few other arguments in the book up next here on the Faith Radio Network.
Dr. Bill Meyer live on Faith Radio.
Welcome back. We're talking about putting Christianity on trial today with our guest Mark Lanier, one of the nation's foremost trial attorneys, who just has this love for defending the faith. As you said, his tent-making job is being a trial attorney, but his real passion is to engage with the ideas of Christianity and defend the faith in a robust way, and he's done exactly that in this new book from InterVarsity Press, Christianity on Trial, A Lawyer Examines the Christian Faith. Mark, who are some of the witnesses that you call to the stand in making your case?
I've had fun with that. What I do is put the witnesses on in a narrative sense, but I use old witnesses, I use new witnesses. I use Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, René Descartes, if you want to move into the more modern time, the Renaissance time and afterwards. And then I use some modern witnesses. There's a fellow named Nick Bostrom, who's probably on most lists as one of the top 10 thinkers in the world. Nick teaches also at Oxford University, and it's interesting. Nick is I use him in the chapter on what is reality, and Nick Bostrom is one of the proponents of the idea, in fact, the author of the idea mostly, that we are not really humans, but we're all part of a computer program. Now, that's not to be confused with the Matrix movie. Here's what Bostrom says. Bostrom says there'll come a time where computers will become so advanced that they're able to process and think through data as a human would. That's in the future at some point in time. To do that within the computer program itself, there'll be some level of consciousness of that human subroutine within the computer program. Who's to say that hasn't already happened and we're not all just part of that human subroutine? And when I first read about that, my son was telling me about it. My son's a teacher at Oxford. I was a bit surprised, and I thought it was interesting. And my son said to me this. He said, "Dad, it's not a scientific statistic, but this is my interviewing people. This is what I think." I said, "Yeah." He said, "I'll bet you at least 35% of the professors at Oxford believe there is a reasonable chance that Bostrom might be right." I said, "Wow." so this is a brand new concept of reality. And so it's fun for me to sit down and to start digesting these. So I call Nick Bostrom as a witness. I call Rene Descartes in that same chapter. Descartes was the one who was trying to figure out what's real and said, if I can't accept anything else, I know at least I am thinking, so I must exist. I must be real. He said, I think, therefore I am, and tried to build a perception of reality out from there as to what he could logically deduce from, with that as the principal building block. And so I call a number of those witnesses, and then I compare and contrast them to the biblical view of what reality is and how we know and perceive reality. And it was a fun exercise for me, in addition to hopefully an interesting book for people to read.
Now, one of the witnesses you call to the stand is J.B. Phillips. For our listeners who are not familiar with him, tell us a little bit about his story and how you use him as a witness in the book.
J.B. Phillips was an Anglican, Church of England, Anglican priest, preacher, vicar, bishop, whatever title he had, in England after World War II. And immediately following the war, he found that a lot of British citizens were leaving the church and leaving their faith, and he put his finger on the reason. He said most of the Brits that are leaving the faith right now were Brits brought up in the 1910s, the 20s, even the 30s, on the basis of little wonderful stories, Sunday school stories of the walls of Jericho or Jesus loves me. And they thought, had this image of God that frankly was not a good biblical image. It was too small. And then after World War II happens, they see the atrocities of the concentration camps. They're living in a nuclear age where two politicians on the wrong day in a bad mood could annihilate humanity as we know it on the earth with nuclear weapons. The medicine had just taken quantum leaps. And as a result, the perception people had of God was so inadequate and so small that they were leaving faith, saying, in essence, the world has told us there's a greater reality than we thought there was when we believed there was a God. And so J.B. Phillips wrote this marvelous book entitled Your God is Too Small. And he spends the first half of the book correcting misperceptions about God, and then the second half of the book explaining his faith. That book was an inspiration to me because we live in an era where even the God of J.B. Phillips is too small. We now know that there are 23 zeros in the number of stars that are outside. So put a 1 and put 23 zeros. And we claim that the God of all not only knows all of those stars, but all of their atoms and all of the electrons in orbit in those atoms. You know, the perception we have of God as we've unraveled the genetic code, the perception we have of God should be massive compared to what it would have been in Phillips' day. And I tease a lot of people who read Phillips' book. I say, your God is still too small because you're still thinking of a little God. You're thinking of a God that's just a little bit bigger than you are. But we've got a God who not only hears the prayers of 7 billion people on the planet, but knows what they'll be praying about tomorrow, next year, next century, if he tarries.
You know, Mark, we're just about out of time, but one of the things that struck me just earlier in our conversation is I was thinking about the experience you had with the trial lawyers at the legal conference in Arizona, and it struck me that there's a lot of parallels to Paul on Mars Hill. In a sense, you took your own profession and what the things that are typically argued in your profession, justice being one of those, the value of human beings being another, and you use those kind of common beliefs among the attorneys to defend the Christian faith. And that is something I think all of us are called to do, regardless of what sphere of influence God has placed us in. Maybe start with what we have in common with those individuals, and then from there move into the defense of the gospel. We just got about a minute left. If you would, tell us, do you have a website available on the book right now, or can you recommend some other places people can go to learn more in addition to buying the book, Christianity on Trial?
Absolutely. I think the best website for them to go to where they'll actually find teaching I've done that manifests the book is www.biblical-literacy.com. That's got links to everything else we're doing. It's all available, and I would love for your listeners not only to do it, but to engage me by email and let me help them through this.
Oh, thank you. Mark, thanks so much for your time. I pray that God will continue to use you both in the courtroom and through your teaching and writing on apologetics. We appreciate this is Labor of Love on this wonderful book, Christianity on Trial, A Lawyer Examines the Christian Faith. Have a wonderful weekend, Mark.
Thank you, Dr. Bill.
That wraps things up for today on the Faith Radio Network. Coming up next, Neil Stavins, Connecting Faith Weekend Edition. Stick with us. Thanks for listening to this podcast from Dr. Bill Meyer Live. If you'd like more information about this show, you can visit our program page at myfaithradio.com.